Well, hello and welcome to what is the 98th episode of the Adoption and Fostering podcast with me, Al Coates.
And me, Scott Hasson-Renault.
Let's be honest, I'm a shower, aren't I? I've just totally messed up.
Yeah, you are. You're terrible. Absolutely terrible.
A husk of a man. Bumbling halfwit. Yeah.
You can explain, because I'm not explaining, because I'm bored now. Scott, well, bored now.
The binary switch to the Omni was on and it should have been off. And if I
Okay, stop now, because that will make no sense to anybody. People don't come to listen to bandwidths and jinging bob, what have you.
I think I altered the phase on the flux capacitor and it's the polarization has reversed.
Okay, Doc, yeah. But can I just say I got blamed for everything and obviously it wasn't my fault. I've been asked to remove headphones and change speakers and all that sort of stuff. So I am where I am and that's it. It's all Coates' fault. And we move on. Anyway, Al, how are you? Quickly, because we've done this before.
I'm bloody marvellous, I am. And you?
I'm amazing because I got to blame you for something for a change. That is your fault. So, way.
Yeah.
I'm going to mark this on the calendar.
Yeah, I'm in London.
Zero. Cass and Rennie, one.
Yeah, I have to say, your sound is atrocious. And when you listen back, you'll be weeping.
That's because you've asked me to change all microphones and speakers and things. So, you know, if you'd left me and then sorted your own system out, then
the first bit was you. And then it was me. Anyway, we've got a guest.
We do, and look at us having a little tiff in front of our guest.
Public tiff.
Shall I introduce our guest?
Yes, please do.
Again.
Yeah, but if you could do it a bit better this time.
A bit of deja vu here, but anyway, so we are joined tonight by the truly wonderful.
Yes.
And I say this with much love and meaning, Dr. Jenny Nock. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, Scott. Hello, Al. Hello, Scott. How are you?
Have you got deja vu as well?
Because I have.
And it wasn't as nice of an introduction the second time round, was it? Let's face it.
It was closer. No. Not as lavish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do you work with adults? Just on the off chance you might. Can you heal rifts between podcast presenters?
Well, I wouldn't want to take that job on. It's too big for me.
I apologise.
And to be fair, she's seen us both in kilts. So, you know, I mean, that's fair. So we've invited Jenny on at long last. It has been a few years in the waiting because we've not wanted her on, of course, but with all that's going on and Jenny, you've kind of had to adjust based on, I'll get you to introduce yourself in a minute, but you've had to adjust kind of what you do and how you do it over the COVID-19 stuff. So we wanted to get you on to chat about the potential of what schools might look like when they reopen. So, but first of all, can you introduce yourself to everybody? We know who you are, of course.
Certainly. So I'm Jenny Nock. I'm an educator and a developmental psychologist. I am really interested, my special area is in early trauma and the impact that has on development throughout the lifespan. I do lots of work with the doctors, with adoptees, with foster agencies, and parents. But most of my work, probably, I don't know, 95% of my work is with schools, with early years, primary and secondary schools, supporting educators in working successfully with children who've experienced early trauma, giving them the support they need. And this has been a busy time for me after the hiatus of the first probably 4 weeks where I think everybody kind of went a bit into alternative world. Been very busy trying to support schools in think about how they're working with families now and how they're going to work with them going forward, and obviously working virtually entirely through webinars, etc. That's just a bit about me.
That was very quick. You said that before.
Yeah, almost rehearsed.
Oh dear me, it's going to be one of those.
I've got the gin and tonic.
Yeah, I bet you are. Yeah,
yeah.
And so I mean, we met in my Adoption UK days, and I became rather a special person. you, didn't I? Let's face it. When Mr. Thornbury retired, decided he was going to hang up his adoption cap and stuff. And I mean, we've worked together on a number of things, including the Tessa stuff for Adoption UK when we first kicked that off, and various other things. So you are quite well known, and in terms of, you know, some of the stuff you're doing, you've worked with a lot of people, including things like that.
I have, yeah. I work with a lot of people. A lot of people who are a lot better known than I am. So I think I'm quite well known in quite a small, narrow circle, as many people are. So work with lots of schools across the UK. And amazingly, tomorrow on our webinar, we've got somebody from Beijing in China, in a national school. So this is a big first for us. And I'm hoping that the world's my oyster now through the internet. But yeah, I've got a lot of connections. I know people like you, Scott, very special, the special one type of people that you replaced you in my affection.
This has turned to a loving.
They have a love idea. Yeah. Look at him with his head in his hands. He's like, oh no. Listen, I need to be validated, Al, so shush and just, yeah. Can I mute you actually? Because I've got the tonight. No, I can't. Sorry.
You can't mute the host, Scott, not even you.
No, I know. Yeah, I wish. Anyway, Al, come on. You're very quiet tonight. Is it because you feel like you've done something wrong?
Oh, me developmental post-traumatic stress is playing up something chronic this evening after that technological trauma that I put us all through. I have a couple of questions, and I was thinking about this, that obviously I see you on Twitter and social media and doing a lot of stuff. And sort of prior to our current circumstances, you were, you know, every week you were in several schools, and that's been for, you know, quite a few years. You've got a really well-known kind of well-known message, you know. You've got sort of good relationships with schools. So what kind of got you into that to start with, really? Because I looked at your biography on your website, a little bit of research, you know, bit of snooping around, because I don't know you like Scott knows you, but I see you speaking all the time. So what got you into this kind of this field of, you know, developmental psychologist?
Well, I started off my career as a nursery nurse way back in the 1970s, so the old NNEB qualification. So I kind of grew up with child development. Anybody who's old enough to remember that qualification will know that it was all attachments. So I started that as a teenager, and then in my mid-30s then decided that I needed to develop my career. So went on to do further training, went into teaching, and finally did a psychology degree, and followed by a doctorate in developmental psychology. Right. I was working in schools, apart from career breaks to have my children. I was off for quite a few years with having three children. But then I got a job in 2004, 2005 in a special school as the outreach manager. So I went into mainstream schools, I taught for 2 days a week in school, and went into mainstream schools advising them on inclusive practice, and became aware, but I was working privately also across the UK from 2001, and became aware during that time in my private work and in my working, I was working in Wolverhampton, that there were an awful lot of children who were misdiagnosed with specific learning difficulties, particularly with autism and with ADHD. And those children often have complex trauma backgrounds. So I kind of relaunched myself into the world of attachment and the impacts of trauma. And that, within my work, both private and for school, became a big focus for me, and I began to get much more interest in work around attachment and trauma than in the other areas, for example, differentiation for different abilities and autism, Asperger's. So over a period then of maybe 3 years, I went from doing a very broad range of training into this very narrow area that was always my specialist area anyway, but
why
became
do you think that was?
I think it's because I was kind of seeing so many children who were kind of square pegs in round holes,
right,
and realizing that schools were not catering for them. They were using autistic strategists for children with autism or strategists for children with ADHD, some of which worked, but many didn't for those children who actually needed a nurturing environment. So it became, I feel like in the first part of my career, where I was very focused on nurture and attachment, and at this, which I don't think I'll have another career change or opportunity at this stage, but I feel like the kind of the wheel's gone full circle. So I learned an awful lot in those years in between. And it feels in the last 6 years, I think it's probably 6 years, it's 6 years since I left my school and started working full time for myself. And of course, became connected with Scott quite early on through Hugh Thornbury and through Adoption UK and people like Sally D and you yourself, Al. So I kind of got pulled very much back into the world of attachment and trauma, which has been just delightful for me.
There's some interesting stuff. Sorry.
My turn. I'll ask again.
Okay. I'm really interested about you kind of talking about this overlap of, you know, children who were sort of they were being responded to and taught as though they had sort of autism, but that actually you were kind of maybe flagging up saying, actually, this, yeah, on one superficially, that may be what it looks like, but actually there's something else going on. And is that something, a kind of a theme that you see frequently, that, you know, people are just... because you can interpret things lots of different ways, but actually not scratching beneath the surface to get to the bottom of things.
Yeah, I think there's still an awful lot of misunderstanding around the impact of trauma, you know, and still, unfortunately, we have educators still, in fact, a head teacher said to me just before lockdown, it isn't trauma, this is just a naughty boy. It's a little boy who was adopted from Kent. And sometimes it's easy, and I have to say, in my world, that's rare, because people who are really interested in attachment and trauma get in touch with me. People who aren't, people who don't really believe it, can I say, who think children are making bad choices, those people don't access my services, because we're on a completely different wavelength about how children behave and what that impact is. So I think there is still a lot of misunderstanding, but we have an attachment and trauma sensitive schools award, which I know I've spoken to both of you about, and we launched that 3 years ago, and we anticipated that we would take on 10 schools per year, and we've actually got, I think, about 70 schools on that now. So we've had far, and to the point where we're not registering people at the moment, because we've got enough, really.
Limited capacity, yeah.
Yeah, and there are, you know, a lot of schools are really tuned into this. So I wouldn't want to give the impression that this is just a fringe group who are interested in the impact of trauma and the importance of that. But there still are nowhere near enough schools who are aware of and are, you know, really using trauma-sensitive practice, which I'm sure that both of you with children of your own will be aware of that. So it's still somewhat of an unknown to many people. And I think that the pandemic hopefully will have opened people's eyes, because my belief now is that every school, every person who works with children should have at least a working knowledge of attachments and the impact of trauma, because every child returning to school will be traumatised in some way. So it can no longer just be an add-on, you know, a training day to be ticked off. It has to underpin practice in school.
Well, that's interesting, because you were saying 70 schools, which is for one person to kind of do that legwork is a lot of work, isn't it? It's really intensive. But, well, I mean, we're talking of tens of thousands of schools across the UK. So if there's one of, you know, how many of yous do we need, that's great English there. How many of you do we need to set across? So in some ways, when that, I mean, this is not a criticism and I didn't expect to go here, but in my head, I think that's not the answer. The answer is go upstream. We need to go upstream, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing is that I always say to people, it's not about an award. That was something that we did at the request of schools. It was not something that we ever expected to do. But for all my schools and people I'm in contact with on Twitter and what have you, so people I've never met, I always say to them, just look at the criteria. You don't need to go for the award. That's irrelevant to us. Look at the criteria and do a self audit and ask yourself, how much of this are we doing? And it's kind of it's a long process. We expect schools to be working with us for a minimum of 3 years, really, to get to the point where they're really flying. But they don't have to be supported by us. They can start small and just, you know, just look at that criteria and ask, well, how well are we doing with this? Is there anything else that we need to do? We need everybody. I just think we need to really be raising awareness around the whole attachments and trauma agenda. My family must get sick of me because I feel passionately about it, but you can't really work with children successfully unless you understand attachments and the impact of early trauma. That's my own personal belief.
Yeah, I mean, I occasionally do some work in schools, and I just go out with the NSPCC statistics, because often children, I feel like sometimes people think it's someone else's kids, it's a different kids. Mm-hmm. But you go, actually, when you break it down, 1 in 14 children experience domestic violence, physical abuse, 1 in 5 domestic violence. You go, this is all kids. This is there's almost nobody not touched by this to some degree. Scott, I've kind of totally railroaded through that. Was there anything?
Well, I'm paying my bills and stuff while you two are just chatting and organising other work and all that sort of stuff.
Setting up, getting our calendars.
Creepers,
out.
Creepers, like, honestly, you two, like, yeah, just okay. Whatever.
Right. In that case, I'll keep going. I'm going to ask. We can talk in abstract terms, but what does a school? Because you're a fantastic saleswoman, so you're constantly, you're never, great. But what does a attachment aware school look like? What does it look like for a school to be nurturing? What are we going to see in a classroom in a high school or a primary school or early years setting?
Well, it might sound a bit cliched. I hope it doesn't. But an attachment committed school really is a school that puts relationships at the centre of everything that they do. They are not using behaviourist principles of reward and punishment at all. So there are no behaviour charts, no stickers, no golden time, no clouds and sunshines, etc. They are interested not in behaviour management, but in promoting and supporting emotional development and self-regulation. They understand, again, it might sound a bit cliche, but that all behaviour is communication. They don't ask that question, what is wrong with this child? They ask the question, what has happened to this child? So they have a solid understanding of the child's backstory, and they try to research that and use that in order to respond to and understand behaviour. So there's a focus on getting children ready to learn, a focus on getting children settled to learn, and only then a focus on delivering the curriculum. So you'll know again yourselves that so many children are sent into school and there is no process for getting them ready to learn and settling to learn. It's straight, let's get down to it, sit still with your legs crossed and let's learn some phonics. And for some children, that works really well. But for a lot of children, probably, 30-40% of children, that doesn't work really well. So it's not saying that the learning isn't important. Of course, the learning is fundamentally important, but the child cannot learn until they are feeling safe enough to be relaxed and safe enough to play and safe enough to learn. So kind of a focus really on getting the child in a place where they can be curious and enjoy the challenge of learning rather than punishing them when they're not able to sit still, for example.
Mm-hmm. You're waiting for me to say something, aren't you, Scott?
Well, there's no point in me saying anything because you just take over. So.
I'll give over. Just
so thinking about all the current circumstances and stuff, and as you know, Jenny, I live in a different country, so it's a little bit different. But I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on things that might be relevant generally to kind of kids going back to school, especially kids who've experienced what the children have kind of experienced. So thinking about things like what teachers might be, the teachers that you speak to and that you train are obviously interested. If they're not at the beginning, they surely will be by the end, but they must be interested in how this is going to impact on children in terms of, they've been, and I'm going to use this phrase within very commas, homeschooled, because a number of them will not have been homeschooled, because let's face it, parents often aren't able for the kind of teaching aspect. And I say that, you know,
are they working?
Yeah. So kind of what are the teachers thinking? What are they saying? What's occurring? What's happening with them?
Well, yeah, it's something massively mixed, because every child and every adult is experiencing this differently, even children within the same family, adults within the same family, teachers in the same school. So there's a massively mixed response. But my own experience over these past 4 months really has been of teachers and support staff and head teachers particularly working endlessly to try to support staff, children, families in the here and now, and also to support them going forward. So there's been, I think, a huge drawing together of school communities. Lots of heads and educators have said to me, well, our relationships in school have really flourished through this, because we've not been afraid to say, I'm not coping.
Yeah.
I'm vulnerable. I'm frightened. I don't want to come into school. I'm really stressed out trying to have my own children at home and, you know, all the things that are going on with this. So I think there's a real mixed bag, really. And I think, obviously, as I said to Al a few minutes ago, people who get in touch with me, they are already interested in the whole attachment and trauma thing. But some schools, of course, are hugely just interested in lost learning, whatever the hell that means. You know, I just have no idea what that means, and catch up. So some schools are still have very much that focus on catching up. But, I've worked probably with, I don't know, at least 500 or 600 people during the last few weeks on webinars about the recovery plan, the recovery curriculum, and all of them are kind of, they know that the learning has to happen, but there are lots and lots of layers that need to go in first before we start looking at that. And as you said, some families have been doing really well with home learning, and some families haven't done it at all. And my advice to all families has been, don't worry about, you're not there to teach your children academically. They'll be learning loads of stuff. And one of the most heartwarming stories that I heard was a teacher, this is about 6 weeks in, and she's a teacher herself, she was at home with her two children, and she said, it was just going into the Easter holiday, I think, or just after the Easter holiday, and she rang me and she said, we haven't done any homeschooling. She said, I haven't done any of the work that the school has sent home. She said, the children get up when they want, they eat when they want, they go to the toilet when they want, they play inside or outside, depending on what they want to do. They go to bed when they want. And she said, for the first time, she's got two primary school age children. She said, for the first time since my children were babies, I feel that as a family, we are really seeing one another and hearing one another. And she said, and there's been loads of learning that's gone on. It hasn't been the times tables or phonics. I want to know curriculum down to that. It hasn't been that sort of learning. It's been about nature. It's been about ourselves. It's been about our bodies. It's been about what we need. And it inspired me, you know, it really touched me, this sense of a family who were able for the first time in maybe 8 years to actually see and hear one another properly. So my advice really has been throughout to schools and to families, just, you know, do what you can do in this and don't worry about that. God, your children never stop learning. They learn every minute of every day.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Can I just chip in? Sorry.
It goes again, like.
No, I think that's really interesting because, you know, for us as adoptive parents, we've missed those primary years of nurturing. And so Peanut, my 8-year-old, she has just really, for a lot of reasons, I've been working in policy, we've not really engaged in education. And a friend, we kind of broke the bubble, sort of was created, and a friend of ours came over in the garden, safely distancing, just in case you report me to the police. And she said, wow, what a change in Peanut. She said, she's a confidence, she's articulate, she's all of these things that, you know, she's forgotten how to spell, but she, as a person, she's developed really, and she said, she's grown, which all kids do, but just that sense of actually belonging, because she missed a couple of years with us. She, you know, she had a really, like all children who've come through the care system. I do have a question from...
this unfair question, I think.
Dear, this is from the friend of the show, Policy Wonk, Becky Brooks.
I'm just reading it now, actually.
Okay. She said, okay, here's a thorny one. Do you think talk of a massive trauma and a lost generation of kids is a bit overblown, considering how we know some have thrived during lockdown and how a nurturing caregiver can mitigate against trauma. If so, and if most kids appear okay on return to school, will that give grist to the mill of the view of some that trauma isn't really a thing and it that affects education? And then it actually makes it harder for those who are advocating for ACEs, because actually there's these kids coming back that have done much better.
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky one, and a lot of it will depend on children's experience of lockdown. And again, one child in a family might have experienced it very well. Another child in the same family might have found it really difficult. So I think there are, obviously that's quite a long question. I think there are, for me, there are three really vulnerable age groups who we will have to be looking at for years hence. So the first group are the children born during this pandemic, because the mothers have been very stressed. A lot of them haven't been receiving antenatal care. They don't go to hospital. A lot of them have had to labour on their own. And even if they've been allowed in the last few weeks, partners have been allowed in, but it's been in the very last stages of labour, which usually by then it's all over by the shouting, and it's the lead up really when you need somebody with you. They've had no support from secondary.
As someone who's not experienced childbirth, I find that very hard to believe. It's all over bar the shouting. I think the shouting is going on, going back. You know, I mean, I don't know. Really.
In for the last 10 minutes. I understand why it's necessary, but, you know, the whole, once you get to that stage, you're not even frightened any longer. You know, your body's taken over, your brain isn't doing very much. And then they haven't had the benefit of support from secondary caregivers, which is leading to increased postnatal depression, because they feel very, some of them have really loved being in lockdown with their new baby. Some of them have found it much more difficult. So I think that's an age group who we're going to have to be looking at when they enter nursery, early years, primary school and secondary school. And then the next most vulnerable age group are the 3s to 7s, because their prefrontal cortex is still very immature. They can't make sense of what's happening, so they're becoming very afraid of other people. There's lots of more separation anxiety than we've seen, than we would tend to see normally. They've got germophobia. They've got an almost pathological obsession with washing their hands and keeping their hands from other people. So I think those children are likely, unless they have a play-based curriculum on return to school, they are likely, many of them, to have mental health difficulties. And we know this from research from previous pandemics. There's been a recent rapid review of the literature that looks at the impact of lockdown and quarantine on the 3s to 7s, I think the 3s to 5s particularly, and those children are 5 times more likely to need mental health interventions than children who haven't experienced lockdown and pandemics, etc. And then the next most vulnerable group is the teenagers, who are hardwired to be away from their parents and siblings, poor things. And you're living this, I'm sure, both of you. And they're, you know, having to be with those people who they are hardwired to get as far away from as possible. They need to measure themselves against their peer group. They've already measured themselves up against their parents. They know what we're like, but they need to be with their peers. So I feel really that secondary school pupils should have been allowed back much, much earlier than they have been. I think they, for them. So I think the group, and I wouldn't say this wanting to limit the difficulties that the 7s to 11s have had, or the 7s to 13s, let's say. But I think that in terms of their mental development, their cognitive development, their emotional development, I think that they are the most protected, they're the most buffered group, if you will. But amazingly, the youngest ones are the ones who were sent back into settings very early, and I think that was a big mistake.
Right. See, now I find that really interesting. I'm going to coin Al Coates' phrase here and say that's really interesting, because it is really interesting that you say that about the teenagers, because I'm worried. And I've said this a couple of times in previous episodes of the podcast. I'm worried about the return to high school, because there's an element of knowing what they are doing. So, I mean, we don't know if we're going to have the option to wear face masks, or you know how that's going to look, social distancing. The schools in Ireland are very small in terms of classrooms, the size of the classroom, not the classroom sizes, although they're quite big. And I worry about the kind of the child, the child with additional needs who maybe has a behavioral problem. Mm-hmm. When I say problem, I don't mean it, you know, the kind of, mm-hmm. what I'm trying to say is, you know, okay, so I've had a run-in with this teaching assistant, so therefore I'm going to cough, and then I'm going to shout COVID afterwards, mm-hmm. like it's some form of threat. That's sort of stuff that I worry about, being a parent of teenagers and adults, because actually it's all very well as a joke, or if you've been kind of, if you've poked bear, you know, because, you know, let's face it, children who are in the teens who've been through all the trauma and kind of all that sort of stuff that we've talked about, they're more likely to be that person. And the school are more likely to have a stance on, you know, if you cough in somebody's face, then this sanction is going to happen. Our children aren't going to learn from that. You know, so can I'm not challenging you. I'm just saying that, you know,
it's
going to be a real worry.
I understand that absolutely, Scott. And obviously I was talking about typical development in those three age groups. But I do think that schools need to have a special provision for those children who've got multi-level trauma. So the way I see it, when children return to school, because we've got, you know, most schools in England certainly have been open throughout. It mightn't be very, very good, but as we move towards a fuller return, I think that we will going to have four levels of needs. So I think that every child, and this goes back to the question that one of your friends asked, I think every child will need a holistic recovery program. It is not just about recovering their learning. They will need a social, emotional, cognitive recovery program, not just focused on, you know, catch-up lessons. I think that some children will need a more personalised approach. We'll need to be looking in more depth at individual interventions and individual strategies that we can put in place, and maybe helping them to process what's happened during this time. There's a third level of need, and this will be children who are really struggling, even though they might have been at home with, you know, parents who can look after them, say. And then that fourth level of need, which is the level that you're talking about, really, will probably be, for people who are interested in this podcast, will probably include many of their children who've experienced mental trauma, will have that multi-layered trauma where their previous trauma is simply tapping into previous fear, previous anxiety, previous trauma, and they're being pulled back, really. You know, the triggers pulling them back to those early traumas that they've had that they might not even be able to remember, but these feelings of fear and anxiety will not be new for them. So they've got this multi-level trauma, and those children will not be able to learn in anywhere but the most safe, secure and nurturing environments. And if schools start to apply sanctions, punishments, if they start to do unpleasant things to them, whatever they might be, those children are going to fail. And I would be asking that question then about what, you know, what sort of a return will be possible, because, you know, we're talking about children who are very impulsive. Yeah. We're talking about children who can't put the brake on. So I think there will, every school really needs to look at those four levels of a recovery program, and they need to take it really, really seriously, because I believe that next year we're going to see multiple exclusions. We're going to see exclusions going through the roof, and it won't help these children.
Yeah. And that's my thoughts as well, you know, it's been interesting, because I think as well that a number of them have thrived, and I know I'm talking from personal experience, like how Jacob has thrived the first 4 weeks. He was not up for doing any schoolwork, and then he got bored and he was like, okay, let's log into Teams and have a look, and then he kind of started to, you know, and it started to. Next year it's going to be, well, from what we've heard, we don't even have a return date yet. So, I mean, think about that. We don't have a return date over here in Ireland. They've said we don't know what the return date will be. It's normally the end of August. As you know, they finish off in the end of May here for the full summer. So, it's, you know, we locked down 2 weeks before the UK, and then... Oh, it's no wonder I drink so much wine, really, is it? But my point is that we don't know what, but we don't know what it's going to look like. They're talking about, you know, half weeks and blended learning, online learning and stuff like that. But actually, My son, Jacob, has thrived with the online stuff because he's not conflicted with the teachers. The SNAs are saying, no, you need to behave. And is SNA an Irish term? Sorry, because I think I might have just... It is, isn't it? Yeah, I can tell by your faces. So the teaching assistant, which is called an SNA over here. Oh, dearie me, I may well have gone just a little bit Irish.
Native.
Yeah. So the teaching assistants may be like, you know, they're not, I'm not saying they're not as trained as they are in the UK, but sadly, I don't think there's as much awareness of kind of the needs of a special education, you know, of a same child like we have in the UK. So it's all kind of, it's just, it's all up for the taking, really, in some ways, because actually we can learn a lot from what we've just experienced and fit around, you know. The same old Becky Brooks put out a poll about something, and I can't remember what it was. It wasn't about homeschooling. It was about kind of almost like the half and half thing. So you have a little bit of school, but you also do some from home. And that's how we're going to, I think that's how Ireland's going to look. And in actual fact, I think that's going to be good. And if you'd said to me a year ago, okay, so you're going to have Jacob at home for six whole months and you're going to have to kind of, you know, I'd have ran for the hills. But actually, he has found his way with it. We haven't pushed him, we haven't forced him. But is that maybe something that you're seeing? Or...
Hugely. A lot of children who've got ACEs, early trauma, and a lot of children with other special educational needs are absolutely thriving without the stress of school. And my hope is that if they can, it won't be possible for all parents, but if parents possibly can, if this has been a good experience for them with their child, that more and more parents will look at homeschooling, unfortunately. It's really... a real big negative in judgment.
Let's not push it to homeschooling, like, yeah. 100%, please. No.
But I think that, you know, we are seeing that children who struggle in school are doing, and they're learning, they're doing fine at home, they're learning, they're doing fine, they don't have this. Lots of children with autism, of course, are much better, much calmer in the life that they're having at the moment. So, yeah, maybe a blend, maybe, but again, in England, that's you know, they're looking at, unfortunately, full return to school on the 1st of September for everybody. I think many schools, personally, I don't think they'll be able to achieve that, to be fair, but that is the, you know, that those are the orders, really. So yeah, lots of children doing much better at home and not having that. And it does make you ask the question, doesn't it, why is that the case? Why can we not have schools, because there are many of them, why can every school not operate in a way that takes into account every child's personality, every child's capability, not just their cognitive ability, but their emotional and social ability? And I think lots of schools have learned loads of good lessons around this, but there are some who haven't.
Yeah, and I think that is the key thing of all of this, isn't it? Every, whether you're in a school or a business or a charity or whatever, you've had to work differently. So you've had no choice but to look at other options. So surely now is the time to go and look at this and say, actually, do you know what? This really worked. Not necessarily, I'm not talking COVID because that's not worked at all for anybody, but, you know, the situation has really worked in terms of finding out different things. So why don't we kind of invest the time, not necessarily, I'm not saying let's invest millions into it, but let's invest the time into looking at ways that we can accommodate all these different learning styles and behavioural styles and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I think a lot of schools are, Scott, to be fair, not enough, but a lot of the schools I work with, you know, they've written recovery curriculums, and if anybody's interested in seeing those, I've got several that people have shared with me. And they're saying...
Look, he's interested now, isn't he?
But they are learning. But they tend to be schools who are already on the journey. And they right, what can we, how can we take this opportunity to really build on what's happened during this time? Obviously, a lot of the learning activities that many schools have been sending home have been very sensory, they've been very research-based, and so many children absolutely thriving through that, you know, and wanting to learn, wanting to, because it's not, learning has become exciting, it's not become sit still for the next 40 minutes. And that isn't how children learn at their best anyway. We all know that. So, yeah, I think that schools, the best schools, will learn from this, and they won't be talking about going back to normal. Then please don't go back to
what.
Please don't go back to that, because that, you know, for, it doesn't suit so many children. It doesn't work for loads of children. School's a nightmare for a lot of kids, and not just kids who've got trauma backgrounds. For many children, you know, they don't like school. Why is that? If school was really promoting curiosity and engagement and research and experimentation, children would love school because they love that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm on my soapbox.
No, you're not. No, you're preaching to the converted, I think.
Can I ask a question? Because I was thinking, was a bit earlier, you were mentioning about the trauma, of the adversity and the level of trauma in children. How are you seeing that adversity play across adults? Because actually there's a lot of adults that are pretty freaked out. And I was thinking about parents who were really anxious about the children returning.
Yeah.
And grandparents were anxious. And also staff. Because I think in the middle of all that, people, it's my job. Yeah. I've got to do it. I don't want to be here.
Yeah.
That it's one of the strange phenomenons of all of this is, you know, I, like probably like you, I've got a job as a social worker, so my job is to support. I'm supporting people in the middle of my own crises, you know, because that's not putting it mildly. Every single person's got a crisis, or a auntie or an uncle. So are you having to support families, and or are you having to support staff? Are they coming to you and going, I'm freaked out?
Absolutely, yeah. So both supporting schools and their staff in supporting families. So not directly supporting parents myself, but working with schools to try to help them to support parents more appropriately. And I think it's like I said, before we were recording, that everybody, no matter how well they feel that they're doing, everybody is experiencing trauma at the moment. We've all experienced loss. Everybody in the country, in the world, who's been affected by it, and I think that's nearly everybody, we've all experienced loss of something, maybe not through death, but loss of freedom, loss of social contact, etc., loss of income. And I think
loss of four holidays, that's what I've lost. I'm just saying.
Yeah. But those are, you know, they're not to be undermined, because those are real losses. They make us feel sad. And we shouldn't be, as you know, somebody said to me a few weeks ago, I've got nothing to complain about, really, because we haven't lost anybody. I said, actually, you've got a load to complain about. Yeah. They didn't go on their holiday. They weren't seeing their grandchildren. They're worried about income. So I think we can't underestimate the depth of the loss that all of us have experienced, and we've all experienced fear around that loss. So school staff and parents are no different, and I think there's lots of separation anxiety from parents, not just children. Parents are experiencing separation anxiety as well, and not just from their children, but maybe from their when they go out. I know I'm not quite as bad now, but I was crazy in the first few weeks. So having to home and leave my husband to go shopping was just a terrifying ordeal for me. One day I actually shouted at a lady in Waitrose, and that was kind of a wake-up moment for me to try to look after myself a little bit better, so I didn't just become, I kept imagining my mum saying to me, Jennifer, you sound like a fishwife shouting at a woman in Waitrose, you know. Just imagining how out of character that was. So I think we've all had moments where we've lost it, and I think for me, I've learned what hypervigilance feels like. I've known in my head for many years what hypervigilance looks like, and I've tried to be empathic, but I know now from a fear, that pounding heart, that huge anxiety. And I think the best schools, certainly in terms of their staff, one of my schools, the head teacher said to them all at the beginning, I'm going to be in school every day. And if you would like to come into school, I would love you to. If you don't want to come into school, I don't want to see a doctor's note. I don't want to see anything written down. You just tell me I'm not able to come into school at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Now, she's had nearly a full cohort of school of staff in school almost all the time, because she didn't put that pressure on them. Yeah. To do things that they're uncomfortable with. Another school, this is one of a school in Northern Ireland who I've been working with closely for a long time. It's an all-age special school, so 3 to 19, all phase, I should say, not all age. And the head teacher there asked me just a few weeks ago about social distancing in school, and he said that some of the staff have found it really difficult to use social distancing with the sevens and unders because the children need to be touched. It's not a luxury. Yeah. They need to be.
Yeah.
He said, so I'm not sure what to do about that, because some of them they really want to have the 2 meter distance, but some of them are not comfortable with social distancing. So I said to him, I think the best thing to do would be to survey your staff and to say, are you comfortable with physical touch or not? Mm-hmm. And if they're not, they need to be working in the top end of the school, because the teenagers can manage social distancing in a way the little ones can't. So we've had a real laugh about it, because he's got people who've been working with sixth formers for the last 10 years. They're now working with the 3-year-olds because they're very comfortable with
Can you imagine?
Nursery teachers working with 14-year-olds because they're not. It's giving that freedom to the staff, not saying you have to do this, you have to do that. Because I wouldn't be able to work with children without touching them. I know that, you know, it's an instinctive thing. But some people are very, very frightened, and they're allowed to be. Yeah. They're allowed to be frightened. So it's schools who are really interested in what their staff's personal capacity is, rather than saying everybody has to do this, saying how do you think you can contribute in this situation? What are your strengths? What are your fears? You know, and I'll try to do everything I can to make sure that you feel comfortable, not just physically and physiologically, but that you feel psychologically safe when you're in school as well. So it's asking those sorts of questions. It's not about PPE and social distancing. It's about something far greater than that.
Well, it is. You're right. I think it absolutely is. I mean, you know, I've had to kind of do a stock take on life and kind of decide that I was going to go and earn some money, because obviously work had kind of gone by the by. And finding myself in retail where I'm actually, you know, different countries, but COVID is the same, whatever country you live in, it is the same, it has the same impact. And it wasn't for the first couple of weeks, I thought, okay, well, you know, it's fine, it's fine. And then I became aware of people not social distancing, so they were getting used to it. And very similar to what you're saying. So, you know, you kind of find I find myself kind of thinking that I'm safe in the environment that I'm in, but actually, am I really? Because then at the weekend, we went out for the very first time, and I mean the very first time, we went into a public space with other people, and I was like, social distancing, come on, please, I don't know who you are, I don't know where you've been, you know, that kind of thing. And it really freaked me out, actually, to the point where I was thinking, okay, so, you know, for now, I'm not being anal about it, and I'm not being like prissy or anything like that. It's just that's my preference. I've been in this little bubble, and it may have been a bubble with the public, but it's my bubble and I feel safe in it. So I don't want to put myself or my family at risk.
Well, it's overwhelming, though, isn't it? Because I was saying in the earlier podcast that we nearly recorded, I was saying that I'd not been out for... I'd literally not left the house, and I've not been to a shop just because I've been working flat out, just doing my...
Oh, you poor love. Poor love.
That's my heart. But consequently, it means that I've not left the house. And for the first time this weekend, I went to a shop since March the 20th, and was overwhelmed at this whole new way of shopping. Just literally someone had to kind of tell me, stop, stand, go there, go here. And I couldn't, I really struggled to function. I'm a grown ass man. But thinking that, well, only in a literal sense. Yeah.
Theoretically.
But thinking
okay then.
Other opinions are available. But just thinking that is quite, you know, for children.
Yeah, it is.
That is, you know, where do I stand? What do I do? Before we even, how on earth are we even going to get to sitting down and let's learn our ABCs?
Yeah.
Or
exactly.
Algebra,
and, you know,
crap.
Like even stuff like going to the supermarket with a certain young 13, nearly 14-year-old, he's actually now refusing to go because it's not that he doesn't want to go shopping, because he loves all that. He loves all the kind of, you know, going and having a look and stuff like that. But he's a bit like what you were saying earlier, Jenny. He's been with a parent who's maybe not been quite so kind of laid back, shall we say. So it's been like, hello, it's a tomato. I don't want to lose my life over a tomato. So you may have a mask and gloves on. I don't. Step back, kind of thing. You know, that kind of. So he's kind of become a little bit paranoid about it as well. But they're all going to be different in the way they deal with it. And, you know, I guess that's kind of, it doesn't matter whether they've had the trauma or they're adopted or fostered or birth or whatever, everybody's going to deal with this differently. It's how we contribute to how they get through it, I guess, is the kind of key thing, is it not?
Absolutely. I think, you know, really minimizing all those triggers, really looking at the language that we use back in school and at home, and you know, taking each child's experience seriously. And I did a parent webinar this morning for a school in Lancashire, and we were talking about the really trying to be empathic with them, and we were talking about the different losses, and I just named five losses for children that I'd seen. So one 14-year-old who wasn't able to go skiing in the Italian Alps. a 5-year-old who hasn't been able to see his dad. He sees his dad every other weekend and Wednesdays, hasn't been able to see his dad for many weeks during lockdown. A child whose parents are both key workers, who is terrified of them dying. Mm-hmm. Child whose first communion was cancelled.
That's very common over here.
There's no graduation ball. There are no residentials. And all of these are huge losses. And I think, again, if we dismiss those and tell the children to not worry, it's going to be okay, that's at our peril. We've got to be really empathic around those losses, and to really, you know, say, to enter into, not to be afraid to say, God, how awful for you. You know, that must be really painful. That must be really frightening. You must be really angry and disappointed about that. So I think it's, you know, trying to enter into their world really and see it from their perspective, rather than the, you know, this privileged position of adult that we all have. And I think, as Al's just said, really, we've all had a taste of what it feels like over the last 4 months. And I hope that I keep sight of that going forward. I hope that I can really keep that in my mind, because it's not a comfortable place to be, that powerlessness that you feel.
So, sort of starting to think about wrapping up, last question, really. Is there cause for hope, though? I mean, I was thinking about the Second World War and, like, collective traumas of Blitz, and, you know, how when groups of people have a trauma, sometimes that can be, there can be a mutual sort of, that mutual experience creates a mutual support and a mutual empathy and a mutual compassion. So do you have reasons to be cheerful?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a great potential for going forward with hope. And I think that's one thing that schools have to do. They have to celebrate hopefulness every day, really. It's something I always say to people. Ask the children, what are you grateful for in this moment? What's a good thing in this moment? Have those times where you all come together and say, what am I sad about, but what am I hopeful about? So encouraging children to really share their feelings, their uncomfortable as well as their positive feelings. I think that we have to be hopeful while recognising that for some children this has been a pretty awful time, and for those children going forward it's going to be hard. I think this is a generation, again, to go back to your friend Becky, I think it was, this is a generation who...
You don't know who Becky Brooks is?
Where have you been?
It's all right, she doesn't listen anyway, so it's not...
Oh my goodness.
Don't worry.
Just such huge... and going forward. And I think if we don't see it as a collective trauma, again, we're missing a trick, really. There have been and will be many, many children who are struggling. That's very attractive and very becoming.
All right, I was just looking at my grey hair. Sorry.
I really apologise.
We have to be hopeful, but we also have to remember that for some children, that recovery will be difficult. There's a really lovely video that you might have come across. It's called The Story of 2020, which a teacher made for her children right at the beginning. And it's have a search for it, you'll find it. It's absolutely lovely. It's only a couple of minutes long, but that shares that hope for going forward. What are we going to take out of this going forward? While not dismissing the fact that for some children, some families, some adults, it's been a really difficult time, and they might never fully recover from it for all sorts of reasons.
Does that
answer the question, Al?
It does. And I mean, on a really serious note, I have to apologise for Scott. Well, no, we've been like naughty school children throughout this interview. It started badly, and we've been just misbehaving, and Scott's been playing with his hair.
No, I haven't. I was conscious because I changed the view of the cameras, yeah. Right? And then all people of a sudden, white went on these grey hairs here. Now, bear in mind, I haven't had a haircut for 5 months.
But people will have tuned in to listen to Jenny. And yes, I know. And he's still got Jenny.
But look at that. Look. I mean, you can't see it if you're listening, well, look, obviously.
I've shaved my head.
Like 6 inches long. That's what they tell me 6 inches look like.
I wonder what this button does. Right, so Jenny, I would really like to thank you for coming on. I've remuted. There you are. You're back.
Oh, right, well, I'm glad I didn't see what I was going to say then. Yeah,
that's good. Jenny, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll have to get you back on in perhaps better circumstances where our technology doesn't let us down dramatically, and Scott's microphone isn't a bit.
I've loved it, so thanks for asking me. And I don't know why I was worried. I didn't even need the gin and tonic. It's been great. It's been great fun. So thanks
a lot. And now she's going to be on every podcast across the land.
She'll be starting her own Bloomer podcast.
Yes, I've done one of them, yes.
I might start my own. I might set up a competition.
Okay, bye, Jenny. Bye, 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 bye. Nice knowing you.
The episode that never got out. Oh, did you press record? Oh, sorry, Jenny. How dare you?
You are so badly.
The
pair of you.
Yes. Well, we'll put links to all your stuff so people can find you and get hook up with you on Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope you have a fantastic weekend. Are you going to have a summer break or?
Yeah, definitely. So, since finished, I think my last job is next Thursday. It's not the 16th, and then I've not got anything until the 1st of September. So,
excellent.
Bits of things coming, but it'd be nice if we're going away. But we're going to enjoy ourselves in Stourbridge on Sea.
So you've got hope for some nice weather in Stourbridge on Sea, then?
Yeah, it's definitely beautiful. Definitely, well, thank you very much for coming
thank
on,
you.
And goodbye, and Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi.
I'm Toby.
Oh, bye bye now. Bye bye. Thank you.